I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
Well, it's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again, you've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
But we ain't killing they army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, Ben, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
Hey guys, check it out. On the line, I've got Peter Van Buren, former State Department whistleblower, author of We Meant Well, and also Hooper's War, a memoir of, something about World War II Japan. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Scott. Thanks for having me back. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Help me with that subtitle, man. I'm sorry.
A
novel of World War II Japan. That's what I meant to say.
Sure. Yeah, a novel of World War II Japan, and it's a book about moral injury. It's a book about what happens to people in war, and it's a book that's set in World War II as a so-called neutral setting that will hopefully allow us to have a conversation about these topics without bringing in the external politics of more modern wars, because unfortunately, the things that wars do to human beings, whether they're the targets or the trigger pullers, are universal and haven't changed a lot since the early Greeks. And whether it's Afghanistan or Okinawa or a fictional battle, as I create in my book Hooper's War, the stories unfortunately are very much the same.
Yeah, man. You know, it's funny because everybody knows that, and everybody says that Sherman said that war is hell, and everybody knows that guys come home from war and then stand at intersections asking people to help them get by before they die. I grew up with Vietnam veterans on the side of the road constantly. You know, it was my whole thing in life. So everybody knows that. But at the same time, we also know that war is what makes us great. War is what makes us us. Without that, what are we except just a bunch of, you know, disconnected, individual, community-less beings? And our army, that's the thing that makes us the USA together. It's kicking butt and stopping bad guys and stuff.
It really is. I mean, it comes as close to a national religion as anything else, certainly a national obsession. The idea that the few things that pull us together are when the United States is, quote, under threat from abroad. And whether that threat is somewhere on the real scale or somewhere on the completely made up scale is largely irrelevant. If you want to look back, I mean, I'm not a big fan of sort of the single theory of history where one event or one theme sort of controls everything. The New York Times, of course, this week has released their 1619 project, which posits that everything in America is based on slavery. And those type of looks, whether it's slavery or whether it's war, are simplistic. But at some point, there's validity buried in there. And the idea that America must exist in a state of conflict, that an external enemy is always necessary, has a lot of validity. Our country was founded on the fighting the external enemy of the British. And there's been relatively few periods in our history where we haven't done that. About the only significant time where we haven't summoned an external enemy is, of course, when we used an internal enemy during our Civil War period to kind of substitute for it. And, you know, that the problem with that is that the casualties are usually multiplied by double, and is, you know, making out the bad guys when they speak the same language gets a little tricky. So we've luckily corrected that mistake and haven't repeated it since 1865. So some good news is mixed in as well.
Yeah, a little bit. Well, you know, it's always seemed to me that partially just because history in American education is so neglected that really people don't know anything about George Washington or even Abraham Lincoln when it comes to
you know, America's founders, that really what we have is FDR, who led America to war against Hitler and saved the economy doing so, they say, brought the unemployment rate down by conscripting 16 million people.
And they, killing half of them, yeah.
Yeah, and they stopped one of history's greatest tyrants. And so that's really where we've been stuck ever since then, right, is World War II.
Yeah, then when you talk about American history, it's very interesting because I would be amused to find someone to point out a high school in America that accurately and thoroughly even gets into the history of America post-World War II. It's been a couple of years since I've been in high school, but you know, I watch my kids go through it. I see friends and neighbors' kids go through it. And American history is incomplete and as poorly taught as it is from you know, the founding up through World War II, sort of tapers off into a gray, fuzzy zone. And then World War II and Korea, and Nixon was bad. And that was, that's kind of it. There's some wonderful attempts, and I'll put in a quick pitch for an Oliver Stone project that's, I think it's on Netflix right now, but it alternates between Netflix and Showtime and Amazon and those things. It's called An Untold History of the United States. And it basically piggybacks on Howard Zinn's work and some other fine scholars, but it presents in a fairly lively documentary form the history of the last 80 years of the United States in a little bit more objective point of view, talking about the underlying themes that we've just touched on very briefly and sarcastically here. Yeah. But this idea of dominance, of empire, of the need for an external enemy, looking into the value of the Cold War if you're a politician running for office. Now, it's an Oliver Stone project, and so there's places where it can't help itself but go over the top. But that is just kind of a little spice along the way. There's a lot of very good history in there. Mm-hmm. And if the listener is saying, well, all right, fine, Scott, you've convinced me I need to educate myself, you could start in worse places than watching a couple hours of that.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the benefits of being a libertarian is that you can indulge all you want in leftist historical revisionism, or for that matter, right wing historical revisionism on whatever issues. And you don't have to abandon your identity in order to look into something like that. Whereas a conservative might go, oh, my God, Oliver Stone and his commie historian co-author, I can't bear to peek through my fingers at what they might say. I don't want to know, and I don't want anyone, I don't want to think that I have anything in common with anybody like that. But when you're a libertarian reject like me, no problem. And there's great value in that series. And in fact, once they started getting to the Terror Wars, I turned it off because I didn't want to copy them in any way. I was in the middle of writing Fool's Errand at the time, and there's too much good stuff in there. And I didn't want to, you know, I wanted to prevent myself from sounding too much like what they were doing. So
I will touch on the word revisionism, because I understand exactly how you mean it, and it's a valid word. But be cautious for people out there about that word, because it's oftentimes flung about when you think someone is sort of revising things, telling you that what you knew was wrong. But I like the word incompletism almost better.
Yeah.
Trying to say the same thing, of course. The idea that...
Well, I kind of like the confrontation in that. That guess what, pal? The official history of everything as written is all false. So if you want to be straight about anything, you're going to have to go back and look at critics. I mean, look at the way they lie to you every day on the news. That's the history next year. You could read an American history book right now in probably any college in America will tell you the Branch Davidians all committed suicide. Well, you know what you need? Some historical revisionism, because that's not what happened, for one example.
Yeah. The thing is what concerns me, and I just came back from Germany, and as part of that trip, I made a visit to Dachau, and I spent a little time poking into the roots of Nazism and things like that. I think if someone is out and out putting out falsehoods, those, if you're willing to engage with the material, you can kind of poke those down fairly quickly. But what is more dangerous is incompletism, if I'm going to coin a phrase here, is the idea that we're going to tell you enough true stuff, but not all of it. And, you know, here's a set of facts that on their own are more or less accurate, but lead you to a false conclusion, as opposed to saying, I mean, what, for example, the theme of what I'm writing on is those who claim America is, you know, Germany in 1933 know nothing about Germany of 1933. You can pull up little points of connection, and you can try to argue that silly elementary school tweets are the equivalent of the Nuremberg speech. But in fact, those are false conclusions. They give you bits of facts that lead you to something, but they are so incomplete that they lead you to an end. I mean, elephants have legs, grasshoppers have legs. Nobody wants to claim an elephant is a grasshopper. And that's the thing. And that's what that becomes very dangerous, because if I come right out and say something completely false and silly, then you can kind of shoot that down. Even a quick drive through Wikipedia might be enough. But if I give you some real information and let you kind of with the idea of walking you toward a particular conclusion, well, then it's more difficult, because you go back and you say, well, gosh, you know, the looks like the Japanese weren't really ready to surrender. So maybe blowing up Hiroshima and Nagasaki was necessary. And simply the fact that there were problems with arranging the Japanese surrender, which is true, but by presenting only that bit of information and nothing more, I've led you to conclude that the annihilation of two civilian cities was perfectly justified. And that's where things get nasty and a little bit difficult.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one thing that I learned very recently in the, you know, kind of annual discussion of the atomic bombings, which, by the way, is why I brought you on today. Don't whitewash the Hiroshima bombing is the subject here. But one little anecdote, and I don't think this came from your piece. It was something else I read, that right after the war, Stimson said, or maybe even still during the war, the Secretary of War said, we ought to go ahead and give the atomic bomb plans to Stalin, because they're going to get them anyway. And by hoarding the secret, we're just going to make the USSR distrust us more. We're going to get the whole post-war era off on the wrong foot. We could end up in an arms race against them and all of this stuff. So we should try to keep it. So just knowing that that was there, and he was overruled, of course, and the Russians got nukes 2 years later, 3 years later, something anyway. And in fact, there were, you know, there's plenty of good reason to believe that Americans did transfer nuclear technology to them in order to help with that, regardless. But it just goes to show that that was the Secretary of War's advice to the president at the time, which you don't have to agree with that at all. I'm not sure I agree with that necessarily, but it sure is important to know that that's there, because at the very least it shows you that the way things turned out, it didn't necessarily have to be that way. It could have been some other way. Whereas the way we're, you know, presented, especially when we're kids in school, is that essentially everything that happened had to happen. You think Truman, our great president, whose name was Truman, would nuke people if he didn't have to? That the American people would have elected a man who would have nuked people if he didn't have to? No way. It goes without saying that it had to be, or else it wouldn't have been. So you get a little fact like that, and you go, wow, okay, maybe, you know, what if Arthur Vandenberg had a heart attack and didn't have a chance to tell Harry Truman, scare the hell out of him, come on, let's build up the USSR that just lost tens of millions of people in this war and pretend they're about to conquer the earth if we don't stop them. What if those people hadn't been there that week? Things might have been entirely different.
And this is why we're talking about Hiroshima, an event of 75 years ago, is because historians study history to avoid repeating the mistakes of the past, whereas politicians manipulate history in order to set up what they want to do in the future. And there's really not a better case study, if you will, than Hiroshima and the aftermath of the atomic bombing. You basically had, from a historical perspective, you had an action taken in the midst of war that happened the way it happened. And we can go back and look at it and say, was it truly necessary for the United States to annihilate two cities full of men, women, and children, non-combatants in almost 100%. But what the politicians did in America was to manipulate a set of facts and take advantage of some very skillful propaganda to repurpose those historical questions for the future, to set up what they expected to be a nuclear conflict with the Soviet Union. And their example, they were going to use Hiroshima not as a way of reflecting on our actions in World War II, but as a way of preparing the American people for the atomic conflict that they felt was imminent. And the way that people are manipulated by history, by constrained use of facts, is very, very, very relevant. Most of your listeners have lived through the post 9/11 years, where the events of September 11th were manipulated into a nearly endless series of wars that are continuing even through today. Many have been with us for the last year, where the events of so-called Russiagate have failed to be successfully manipulated to end the Trump presidency. These lessons are not in abstract. This isn't grad school, you know, five pages with footnotes if you want the B+. This is extremely relevant stuff. And by using a historical example, we have, A, we gain the advantage of perspective. B, we maybe remove some of the immediate emotion. And also we take advantage of the fact that we have a more full set of information to work with than we have on more contemporary events. It unfortunately, in our transparent democracy, takes decades for information to finally slowly creep out of government hands, because of course controlling what information is public allows you to control the conclusions the public reaches.
Hey guys, Scott here for Liberty Under Attack Publications. Looking for a liberty-focused publisher? Liberty Under Attack publishes books and strategy guides for individuals looking to increase their personal freedom. They assist authors through the entire publishing process, proofreading, editing, cover designs, paperback and Kindle formatting, and full audiobook narration and post-production. Tell them Scott sent you and get 20% off a full-service deal. To get some one-of-a-kind books or for more information, visit libertyunderattack.com. Hey guys, check out Listen and Think audiobooks. They're at listenandthink.com and, of course, on audible.com. And they feature my book, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, as well as brand new Out Inside Syria by our friend Reese Ehrlich, and a lot of other great books, mostly by libertarians there. Reese might be one exception, but essentially they're all libertarian audiobooks. And here's how you can get a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think audiobooks. Just donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate. Now, there's some important truths and narratives that were coming out of the atomic bombings at the time that you're saying they weren't just, you know, covered up for, you know, reasons of the American government losing face for doing such a thing to, right, to places that were, in fact, not military bases as originally claimed and all that, but really to set the American people up to get used to life in the era of atomic wars. Yep. And so talk a little bit more about that. And sure. in specific, how do you know that? Like, what are the examples of where they decided that this is what we're doing and this is why we have to spin it this way?
We're going to jump ahead here of the question of were the atomic if you're sitting in the Oval Office in late July 1945 and someone says, hey, Mr. President, should we drop these atomic bombs? Let's set aside the question of truly were those bombs necessary to end the war at that point in time? And it's a difficult, just preference it by saying it is a difficult question, particularly when you're looking backwards and trying to place yourself in that room, you know, in late July 1945, and think like 1945 people, not 2019 people. But let's just skip ahead and use as a starting point that the atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and decimated two undefended cities, almost entirely populated by non-combatants, and the war ended, which it absolutely did. And the American people at the initially were fed a line of, so let's then we go back and look at the messaging as we talk about it today. The original announcement of the bomb by Harry Truman was an absolutely vengeful statement. I mean, biblical proportions, as they say. He said, "We are now prepared to obliterate more rapidly and completely every productive enterprise the Japanese have above ground in any city." That's not like, hey, we're going to destroy their power to make war or anything. I mean, he was pretty straightforward with his word choices. And that particular speech went on to talk about mass casualties and spoke of cruelty at levels previously unknown on this earth outside of biblical times. That message of vengeance was the initial messaging, and it played well to a population that was weary of war. And basically, that's what stood for about a year and a half, to the extent that people even focused on it. And when in writing what was a fictional book about World War II, I read through an awful lot of archive materials. And there wasn't as much conversation about the nuclear bombing of two cities as you might think would it be engendered. It was focused, the focus was on something else, the end of the war. For want of a focal point, it was John Hershey's 1946 article in The New Yorker that kind of began the change in conversation. It wasn't when you study history, you pick out these events because it's a great way to talk about history. It's not like prior to Hershey's article, no one talked about Hiroshima and, you know, suddenly it fell from the sky, so to speak. It isn't that case at all. GIs were coming back. Photos were leaking. This was a time when information spread very differently and much more slowly. But the point is that John Hershey was one of the first reporters that went to Hiroshima to report on what happened there and was not censored. The war had ended. People were no longer, the military was less concerned about sitting on these type of articles. And there was certainly no tactical information that could be accidentally given away. And Hershey wrote a brilliant article, which later became a book, which explained in terrifying, horrific detail what happens to a civilian population undefended when they are nuked. And this caused coupled with the timing of it, it was a year and a half or so after the war. Americans were anxious to forget as much as they could, and this was an economic boom that was starting. We all know the story of the post-war economic boom for most people in the United States. And suddenly there was an opening for reflection about who we were and what we did. And Hershey, almost by accident, stepped into that. Now, the problem is that this period of reflection over how America made war was coinciding with what the government knew was the beginning of what we call the Cold War. Inside Washington, they were no longer thinking about having defeated the Nazis and the Japanese. All eyes were on Moscow, and everyone was planning on how this next war was going to play out. We were not long away, a year or so away from what became known as the Berlin Airlift, the Iron Curtain. I mean, all this stuff was percolating in Washington, and they knew this was coming. And the idea of softening the American people to the idea of nuclear war did not fit with the program. And John Hershey's article and the introspection that it caused just were the wrong messaging for an America that Washington knew they were going to push into the Cold War. And the Cold War was a nuclear conflict and was going to involve the annihilation of multiple Russian and or Chinese cities. And we didn't need any soft selling on that. So something had to be done. And what was done was essentially the last 60 years of propaganda. But it started, again, for lack of a pinpoint starting point, it started with a 1947 article by Secretary of War Henry Stimson, who I think you mentioned earlier. He actually wasn't the author, because history does enjoy irony. The author was McGeorge Bundy, who your listeners will recognize as one of the best and the brightest in the John F. Kennedy crowd that drove America into Vietnam and the atrocities that characterized that war. So McGeorge Bundy wrote this article, basically creating the talking points for the American government and the American people for the next 70 some years, that the atomic bombs were necessary to end the war quickly, that the atomic bombs not only saved the lives of, and by the way, the numbers jumped from every time you go through a historical reference, the numbers get bigger, you know, jump from 10,000 dead Americans invading Japan to 100,000 to a million on the beaches. And
right, that's what President Bush Sr. had said, that, hey, yeah, a million American boys would have died invading Japan.
Yeah, and you can find references to that. But the interesting thing is, as you walk those, if you walk back the stories and articles and references and think tank pieces, the number of Americans that was going to be killed in that invasion increased by a factor of 100-fold in the 5 years after the war ended. But more importantly, Stimson began laying out the idea that not only did we save American lives in the use of the atomic bomb, we saved Japanese lives too. That, you know, if it would have been, as they say, you can't make this stuff up. I mean, this article, which is really the beginning of it all, it was in Harper's Magazine in February of 1947, and maybe you could post a link to my article, which has all the references.
Definitely
here.
Will.
But I mean, the idea is it said we saved Japanese lives, because dang it, if we would have had to conduct a land invasion of Japan, we would have had to kill more of them little yellow fellers. So, you know, the people who died at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, man, they were kind of the crumple zone for the rest of Japan instead of having to kill more of them. And there was, in a sense, in February 1947, in written form, the creation of the what I call the Hiroshima myth, and which became the basis of the Cold War, that annihilating cities was part of the way nuclear war was going to work, that Americans were ready for this, and that, gosh, in a way, it's actually going to help them, because the more Russians we kill in that initial blast, the less likely they are to continue the war, etc. I mean, it became, it's no joke that.
No, that was a little Freudian slip there about the Russians, right? Because it was a demonstration for the Russians.
Oh, that's another line of argument. That's why I started where I did is the bomb dropped. I started with that point because one of the arguments about the unnecessariness of the Hiroshima Nagasaki bombings at all was that they weren't needed to stop the war. They were done as a proof of concept for the Russians. You know, like, look what we got. You want to mess with us, this is what you're messing with. So I kind of skipped over the arguments against dropping the bombs because I wanted to focus forward here on how America manipulated this.
I only brought it up now because you just called the Japanese Russians, so I thought I would.
Oh, okay. Are they different?
It was, you know, it's a slip was all.
Yeah. But it doesn't matter because they're not Americans, and that's what
right.
Really is important.
They're all Russians, everybody. Or they're all Japanese, same difference.
Whatever.
The enemy.
The enemy is really what matters. And so there was this creation of what I call the Hiroshima myth, and it has survived mightily because in many ways it became the core of convincing Americans that the Cold War was a noble cause and what we were going to have to eventually do. And it was almost a certainty. If you read back through the archives in the 1950s, it was almost a certainty inside Washington that we were going to go to nuclear war with the Russians, possibly also the Chinese. It really wasn't until the 60s when the Russians started to get a little stronger about this. And I think there was a little bit more distance between World War II that American government started to kind of imagine maybe we weren't, this wasn't as inevitable. I haven't looked into it as closely, but potentially you could argue somewhere around the Cuban Missile Crisis, it changed from inevitable to maybe something we could avoid. I'm not ready to go to the mat on that statement, but I think it's one that's worth exploring.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you haven't read The Doomsday Machine by Dan Ellsberg yet, definitely do.
The bottom line is that Hiroshima was, the aftermath of Hiroshima was a myth that was specifically created for propaganda purposes by the United States to prepare the American public for the inevitable nuclear conflict to come. It served the interests of the United States government long past the Cold War and still kind of pops in around the edges. Yeah. When you've got to explain away accidentally droning a wedding party in Afghanistan to kill one terrorist, the Hiroshima myth is underneath all that. It underlies these type of things. You hear military people and politicians today saying things like, hey, if the people of Fallujah didn't harbor terrorists, wouldn't have been necessary to destroy them in the process. So there are hints and there are notes of the Hiroshima myth that persist all through modern time. It's proven to be an extraordinary piece of propaganda, and it's still very much a part of us today.
Yeah, man, you're right about that. It's like a big Milgram experiment or something. Hey, it's required that you continue to endorse this, as everybody else does, and you don't want to look like a hippie. Okay, good. That's good enough. And think about just how shallow and ridiculous this argument is, that to save American GIs, admittedly conscripts, I mean, don't get me wrong, but to save American GIs, we get to nuke women and children? And Ralph Rako, in his article, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, says, well, what if we're, you know, we're just talking about the Nazis who didn't have nukes, but instead they would just round up women and children in the town square and then just machine gun them like that. Would that have been okay for the Americans to go into Hiroshima with our infantry and round up the population into the center of town and just straight machine gun them all to death like the Gestapo in order to get the government in Tokyo to surrender? Because that's what the Gestapo would do, the enemy in this story. That might be what the Japanese imperialists would have done. As brutal as they were, but that's who we are now. And then, but somehow this is, as you say, totally good enough. In fact, look at Waco again. Well, we got to get that David Koresh. Yeah, but there's a bunch of women and children in there. Hey, God dang David Koresh, I heard he deals drugs, blah, blah. Yeah, kill them all. We gotta save the lives of a couple of cops who picked this fight in the first place.
It comes down to a very core part of America and our, I'll just say policy. I don't want to even say foreign policy. And that is expediency always seems to trump morality. The right thing to do under difficult circumstances is kind of how this stuff gets spun. You know, nobody is proud of killing women and children, but there's always the but, you know, we got to get bad guys off the streets. And, you know, if there's some collateral damage, that's a sad but unfortunate reality of things. Mm-hmm. And that, in a way, describes Hiroshima in a word. It describes the atrocities that fueled the Vietnam War. It describes every civilian drone strike in Afghanistan or Iraq or Lebanon or Syria or Libya or wherever. Do we need to spell it out? Sure, why not?
Yeah.
You know, take a look at Libya. You know, the idea that we had to get rid of Gaddafi because he was an evil guy justified the destruction of the country and turning it into an ungoverned wasteland.
We had to burn the village in order to save it.
In a way, that's the Hiroshima myth.
Yep. You know, there's a new one for our time, too, which is George W. Bush's absolutely unprovoked, aggressive invasion of Iraq in 2003, where they just marched the Marines and the 3rd Infantry Division straight in from Kuwait. And now anything less than that is fine. And you look at, there was a great example of this, was Jeremy Scahill on the show with Bill Maher one time on HBO a few years back, during Obama years. And Scahill saying, look, I mean, Obama's murdering people. You're mentioning wedding parties. I'm pretty sure that was one of the points he made. You're talking about innocent people are being killed by these drones. A 500-pound bomb is not a scalpel. It kills innocent people. And Bill Maher goes, yeah, but compared to George Bush marching the 3rd Infantry Division into Iraq, that's nothing. It is surgical in comparison to this other bigger thing. So we could drone strike all damn day.
Yeah, and this idea that evil scales and that it becomes more evil or less evil and that somehow matters, I just have a hard time with that. But it rests at the core of America's actions. We like to imagine ourselves as nice people, and we want to have things like the Hiroshima myth or what you were just describing, as a way to kind of remind ourselves that we are nice people, that, you know, hey, make mistakes, everybody does. One of the things that has become so offensive to me as a thinking human being over the last 3 years is how all this gets garbled when it's run through the Trump filter. And, you know, we have revisionism about George W. Bush and how he did it. And certainly we have completely whitewashed the Obama years of war to the point where we're now, every time I see an article about Yemen, my ulcer just grows. That I'm like the Grinch, you know, my ulcer grows 10 times more because it's like, well, you know, Trump is doing this in Yemen. Yes, he is. But did we already forget how we got started in Yemen? We did forget that, didn't we? And in a way,
it's like, man, I wish they could just forget that Obama did it. That way they'll finally, you know, raise their voice against Trump. At least that is now when it matters.
Yeah.
You know, because you're right. Because you never turn against their savior, the Democrat from Illinois.
And this idea that history is that malleable and we are that manipulable is why essentially the Hiroshima myth has survived 75 years after being birthed in a magazine article in February of 1947. We are willing participants in all this. And it's really quite shameful. I had a real kind of branching off of this, an interesting experience in being in Germany, and having lived many years in Japan. You know, when you go to Hiroshima, the museum there, everything starts on that August 6th morning. There's no sense in Hiroshima that Japanese imperialism started 30 years earlier and inexorably led to, justified or not, what happened at Hiroshima. Uh-huh. The Germans, to give them some credit, have a much, much deeper sense of this and are willing to talk about it. In Dachau, for example, the museum starts with the events of World War I and what happened in Germany between the wars, the stuff that made the rise of a strong man who happened to be Hitler. It could have been any number of a bunch of other guys, but Hitler was the one, you know, made the rise of a dictator as close to inevitable as history allows. And you walk away with a much better sense of having been educated, of understanding things, how pieces fit together, I guess. So, I mean, the Hiroshima myth, I would be remiss to say that has been strongly driven and supported by the Japanese themselves. They are thrilled to death to claim as much victim status as possible for those two terrible days, but they work closely with us to make sure that those days stand in isolation from everything that happened before in their case and everything that happened afterwards in our case. And so in a way, the politics of the Cold War contributed to the victims themselves supporting a false narrative because it tended to work out for everybody.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it's sort of like what you were talking about with slavery and war at the beginning here in America, where same kind of thing in Japan there, where people don't like looking back and being honest about what's going on. They're too, they identify themselves with the collective too strongly. And so it's an attack on their own psyche. I mean, that's what this is all comes down to, right? Yeah. Is social psychology. And whose side are you on? And what would your dad think of you if he knew that you changed your mind and you agree with Jane Fonda about something now or whatever it is? And so therefore, kill them all before you think that you are like Michael Moore. Which makes sense to me, too, right? No, who wants to be like Michael Moore? But that's the way everything is framed. So you're either pro-America or you're not. And so if you're willing to say, look, slavery was absolutely this bad, and the genocide of the Indians and the and of the Filipinos and everybody else, for that matter, was this bad, if you're willing to do that, essentially, it almost always comes packaged with a full-scale anti-Americanism from the point of view of the right. It's hard to find people who are American patriots, but who also are perfectly happy to explore all this to find out exactly what all it means for us then and now and in the future and this same kind of thing. And so it's pretty easy to reject. In fact, that was if I really wanted to do this interview right, Peter, what I should have done at the beginning, if we want to really persuade people, the first thing I should have done was lead with, let's talk about all the conservative Republicans and generals and admirals who opposed the war, because that's the thing that gets through to people the most. And I've had people freak out about, and heard a lot of stories too, people freak out if you're against nuke in Japan. You must be the most anti-American communist piece of garbage in the world. And then you show them that, oh yeah, well, that's what MacArthur thought too. And that's what Eisenhower and Nimitz thought. That's what Leahy, the admiral, chief of staff to the president, said, don't do this. I was not taught to make war against women and children. What in the world? And so, and then they go, oh my God, a bunch of admirals and conservatives and Republicans and MacArthur, of all people, was against nuke in Japan?
And it becomes very difficult. I mean, the term cognitive dissonance is you know, the, to admit you're wrong, to admit that you made sacrifices for the wrong cause is humanly very, very, very difficult. And it's perhaps even unfair to expect people who made those sacrifices themselves or sent their sons and daughters to make those sacrifices. It's perhaps even unfair to try to ask them to see this true as it truly is. But we're not them. And our job as historians or as thinking people or as folks who are a step or two removed is to try to look at these things more objectively. Honest to God, if I lost an arm in the Vietnam jungles, to try to tell me that that was all a complete waste of time, that's a hard thing for me to get myself around.
Right. I agree with that.
I see these the Parkland kids on TV and the Parkland dads on TV, and I just feel for them, because to try to get someone who's suffering the loss of a child to objectively talk about these issues, it's impossible. It's not even fair to expect them. Unfortunately, there's plenty of folks who will exploit that for their own political goals. But when you pull back a step or two steps or three steps, we're supposed to be smart enough to do that. And that's why in talking about these issues and in the book I wrote, I said it in a fictional portion of World War II in hopes of giving the reader and myself that distance.
Yeah.
The book revolves around a fictional struggle, and it's all true, but it didn't happen. And that means that hopefully we can look at these events as objectively as human beings are capable.
Yeah. Well, you know, you were in Iraq War II, not as a soldier, as a State Department official, but doing work. I read the book, finally. We talked about it, I don't know, a year ago or something. The great book, We Meant Well. And you've been able to, I guess, even while you were there, you're getting over it and you know, started blowing the whistle and about what was going on to the American people even during that time. But you know what? You're not alone. There are a lot of people who served in, as they call it, in Iraq War II and in Afghanistan and in other wars over there, you know, in this century, who have changed their mind about this, who are now members of concerned veterans.
And I don't claim any virtue because I happened to see through it while it was happening to me. What I'm saying is that it's unfair to expect everyone to be able to do that.
Agree. Yeah, no, I agree with that. I guess I'm just saying, yeah, I mean, I don't, I do anti-war radio here, but the point is not to like seek out the fathers of dead veterans and try to argue with them or anything like that, or even the guys who were in the war to confront them with it necessarily, because, well, as you're saying, you know, these are people who suffered losses. I don't know. Some guy who was in Iraq War II, I don't know how many of his friends died in front of him. I'm not trying to pick a fight with a guy like that. He's the implementer of the foreign policy. My fight is with the guys at the AEI and the Defense Department who got us into the war, of course, you know?
And just as individuals, just as an individual myself, there are parts of my life I've been able to be introspective about, and there are parts of my life that I haven't been able to reach that, and that I stumbled into it with Iraq, good for me, that I didn't do it with something else, bad for me. And I don't expect that of other people, and it's unfair to ask it of other people. Yeah. What is fair is to ask folks who do already have that distance to be a lot more thoughtful about it, and that either have that distance because they're personally removed from a modern event, or because we're looking back at history at events that none of us have more than second, third generational contact with.
Yeah.
And at that point, our excuses for not being introspective start to get a whole lot fuzzier. The idea of historically looking back, for example, I mean, we've around the question throughout this interview about were the atomic bombs actually necessary, is intellectually an interesting question, and it's something that is worth talking about to a certain extent because it informs the future. That's where the value always is. I mean, you can go back and look at it, and the key is always, is there some way that in the present that you can pull in some of the perspective that of the future. In other words, you're making decisions in your life right now. But I mean, you know, should I buy a new car? Who should I vote for? Should I do this, that, or the other thing? I mean, you know, we're constantly doing that. And of course, in retrospect, when you look back at decisions, you have more information and more distant, you know, all that good stuff. So I mean, the key is always, is there any way that to let the what bring that perspective in. So when you zoom into the Oval Office in June of 1945 and say, you know, Mr. President, we're nearing the point where we need a decision on the atomic bomb. If you simply confine yourself to that window of time and say that Harry Truman, you know, had a birth defect that didn't allow him to think ahead, whatever, you know, then the decision to drop the bomb becomes as obvious as it seemed to be to Harry Truman in 1945. The thing is that you hope that our leaders are bigger men and women than that. And that's what didn't happen in 1945. I'm going to leave aside the question about that this whole thing was a demo for the Russians. I don't think that was a driving force in the decision to drop the bomb. I think it was in Harry Truman's mind. You know, he was a diarist. He kept, I don't know how he had time to do anything else. He kept incredible diaries. Stimson kept diaries as well. His diaries are actually available in the Yale Library, and I actually read through some of them. He has this incredibly neat handwriting. It's really kind of very easy to work with. So both of these, we knew a lot about what these guys were thinking. We're not trying to put words in their head. We knew what they were thinking. And Truman, for his part, was not really thinking very far ahead. And so I think while the Russian thing was certainly probably more on the mind of some of his generals, in Truman's mind, he was a simple man, and he was told that we got a bigger bomb that's going to make a bigger mess, and that's the kind of we feel that the Japanese are need just one. They need a big push to get them to take the next step, which is to surrender. And this bomb is going to do that. And we've been working on it all these years, and it's ready to go. Sign here, sir. And I don't know from my own reading that it was a lot more complex than that. We had been blowing up people for a long, long time in World War II. Civilians had been targeted from the opening days of the war, long before America was even involved. And I think without fully understanding how evolutionary nuclear weapons were, I think in July of 1945, this was just seen as the obvious next step. That said, like I said, we hope that our leaders are bigger people than that and think further ahead than that. And Truman didn't. The thing about bombing Kyoto and bombing some other places, Stimson was the one who argued against Kyoto. There was a target list drawn up, and it was essentially a series of cities that had not been heavily bombed otherwise for whatever reasons. The military definitely wanted to blow up something that hadn't been blown up before. They really were interested to see how this weapon worked. Keep in mind, they only had a lot of theory and a handful of small-scale tests that out in the desert in the United States. They didn't really fully know exactly what was going to happen. And they wanted to know exactly what was going to happen, because this was going to be the weapon they were going to be going forward with post-World War II. So there was clearly that. And Kyoto was on that list because it hadn't been bombed during World War II. And Stimson said, hey, I took my honeymoon there. It's a World Heritage Site. A couple of the other people in the State Department said, hey, if we blow up Kyoto, it's going to piss everybody off because it's a World Heritage Site. And Truman said, fine, I don't care what we blow up. What's next on the list? There wasn't really an argument per se. It was more of a, fine, you don't want to blow up Kyoto? Can we blow up number two? What's that? And that was kind of it. It's like you and I are walking down the street and there's three or four restaurants and I say, hey, Scott, how about this one? And you say, no, let's go that one. Oh, okay. I mean, it's really that kind of casualness.
Yep. So kicking over an ant pile.
Yeah. And it was fine. I mean, the idea was Nagasaki itself was the secondary target, right? It was supposed to be a city in, I think, Fukuoka. I'm not sure now, but that's the idea. It doesn't matter. It didn't matter. As long as it was more or less a virgin target, it didn't matter which one it was. So in 1945, the decision was, I think, seen as not that big a deal. I think the big deal came afterwards when we truly understood the power of these weapons. And particularly as we moved into the Cold War, where the way that nuclear war was envisioned was not as a capstone to 4 or 5 years of conventional conflict like World War II was kind of building up to this, but that nuclear weapons and the destruction of whole cities was going to be the opening of the new war. That's where you get into the vengeance kind of thing. It's like, well, if the Japs hadn't bombed Pearl Harbor, and here's a list of Japanese atrocities throughout the war, and, we lost all those guys in Guadalcanal, and so they were really spoiling for this. Yeah. And it fits, it's a very nice narrative that, America's anger rose, and finally our righteous smiting occurred. But it got trickier when you're talking about what was believed to be headed in the future, where on Monday morning, Moscow was a happy little city. And by lunchtime, it was a smoking ruin. And that was the opening shot and possibly the closing shot of a war. And so the destruction at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I think, caused people to start to think about this in ways that, honestly, I don't think Truman was considering in July of 1945. Yeah. Others were, but not Truman.
Hang on just one second. Hey guys, I got to tell you about WallStreetWindow.com. It's the great Mike Swanson. He made a killing on Wall Street back in the day, and now he sells advice for reasonable prices. You need to know what to do to protect your assets. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey guys, I know you're going to love Will Griggs' new book we just published at the Libertarian Institute, No Quarter, The Ravings of William Norman Grigg. It's wonderful. It's terrible. It's devastating. You'll laugh. You'll get angry. You'll miss him. You'll be inspired to fight for freedom. With perfect cover art by Scott Alberts and a brilliant introduction by Will's great friend and protege Thomas R. Edlam, it is a fitting legacy for a brilliant man and nearly tireless defender of liberty. Get No Quarter, The Ravings of William Norman Grigg, in paperback or Kindle on Amazon.com. Hey, tell me something. What year did you start working for the State Department?
I joined the State Department in 1988. Ronald Reagan was president, and I left in 2012 when Obama was president. Mm.
So you joined, I was going to say you remember the Cold War, but you joined right when the Cold War was ending and the Soviet Union was falling apart.
Yeah. We were there for it. It was a heady time, as they like to say. I was actually in London working at the. I worked 2 years in London, 1991 to 1993, which was a fascinating time because that's things. You know, the wall went down in 89, but it took a while for things to really happen. And so we were being flooded with Russian stuff during those years in London, because London, as we all know, was always one of those magical crossover points like Vienna or Prague, where the good guys and the bad guys saw some neutral territory. And so it was an amazing time. We saw, for example, this great exodus of Russian scientists who poured through London. Guys who worked on a lot of all sorts of nasty weapons programs and stuff, who wanted to go to the United States or were moving to the United States. And we saw them pour through places like London. So, no, it was a very exciting time.
All right. So, because what I want to ask you about is the threat of nuclear war now, because I've read things by people who seem to be really responsible types. For example, William Perry, who was Bill Clinton's Secretary of Defense, saying that now is, and he's not alone, there are other people saying this too, that now the threat of nuclear war between the United States and Russia is as great or even greater than at any time during the Cold War, the original Cold War. That's because, I guess, of NATO expansion, so that the buffer zone is now essentially non-existent, but also the advent of hypersonic missiles and the shortening of warning times and all these things. What do you think?
I can't subscribe to that theory. One of the things that was so prominent during those years was how the threat of nuclear war had diminished, because one of the great benefits was backing down all of the hair trigger stuff. The hair trigger stuff, the idea that you might launch against me, so I better be ready to launch against you. And, well, you're ready to launch against me because I'm ready to launch against you, so I better be extra ready to launch, you know. And this kind of built up to the point where everybody had their finger on the trigger and was starting to apply just enough pressure to get the ball rolling. That all kind of tuned down. And in the aftermath of the Cold War, during those years when I was in the State Department, the stuff I was seeing and reading and being told was all built around accidents. The great fear was that the Russians would lose control of nuclear weapons, that they would end up in the hands of third parties, that the fact that people stopped kind of caring, the Russian military stopped doing all the maintenance that they needed to do on the weapons, meant that there was danger of accidents and things like that. You know, you have to ask, I think we have a firm enough understanding that the use of a nuclear weapon between the United States and any other nuclear armed country means we're racing to Armageddon. We're not, that there's not a stop point easily found in this game. And this was always what restrained during the Cold War, right? Was the idea that there was no halfway on this stuff. And I don't know, I can't think of a justification to explain why anyone would think there's a halfway in it now. And at the point where there, where both sides acknowledge there's no halfway, once we start, we're both going to be more or less obliterated. That was an extremely powerful disincentive to war during the Cold War period. And I can't imagine it doesn't exist now. I also can't imagine why anyone would. I mean, there's plenty of reasons to keep building weapons. I mean, you know, that's the industrial military complex. But to use them is a different story. Mm-hmm. This is to just enlarge. I mean, this is the whole idea about why there will never be a nuclear weapon holding Iran. The day that Iran has a first nuclear weapon will be the day that the United States and Israel obliterate it. Because the idea that they would, that we could reach an Armageddon situation in the Middle East is simply not acceptable. There's only one and a half nuclear powers in the Middle East. That's the United States and Israel. And that's it. It will not be allowed to change. And I think the Iranians also know that, by the way. But that's neither here nor there. There can't be a nuclear standoff in the Middle East. It simply will not happen. And the United States and Israel will assure it won't happen. If you're not sure if I'm right, please go back and look at what the Israelis did to the Osirak reactor when Iraq was getting even vaguely close to developing something, what they did to the Syrian reactor that supposedly the North Koreans helped them build, et cetera, et cetera. You're not going to get there. The mistakes of the Cold War in that sense are learned. The Americans who wanted to destroy Russia's nuclear capability and whenever it was, 1947, 8, whenever that was, you know, that argument has resonated with the United States and Israel in the Middle East.
Yeah. Well, in other words, that and LBJ should have preemptively attacked China before Mao was able to get his hands on one, too, then.
Well, no, the problem with China was Russia. I mean, it wasn't a one-on-one deal. You couldn't have attacked China without bringing on nuclear war with Russia. The thing is that you could have, I'm not advocating, but you could have attacked Russia at its nascent nuclear stage and nobody else would have done a damn thing about it.
Yeah. Now, as far as the standoff between the U.S. and China or the U.S. and Russia, that, hey, nobody wants to lose their capital city. They'd be crazy to use these nukes because then they'd be dead. I'm not so sure that precludes the possibility of war. I don't know what the chances are of this kind of thing. But when you look especially at sort of like we've been talking about this whole time, the level of just total nonsense and just lies and false premises and ridiculous points of view and regurgitated propaganda talking points about what is even going on here from American side. About containing and defending the world from Russian aggression and all this crap. And that's just not really what's going on here at all. That America is attempting to force our world empire even on Russia and China, who are powerful enough to be independent from us. And so we can't stand it. But if you tell anyone in Washington, D.C., come on, you guys know the Clintons and Bushes picked this fight, caused this problem, they would deny it. No, it's all Putin's fault. The Harvard boys, what's that? That's ancient history. You know, the war against Serbia? No, I don't know what you're talking about. The color-coded revolutions? I've never heard of those. Yep. But what I do know is Russia, 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 Russia. And so that's the kind of thing that makes me think that we can get into a war, is that these people are, like, in a sense, insane, right? Like, their thinking is so off base that I could expect anything to happen.
Well, let me reassure you, and that is in a way that I think will resonate, and that is war is not as profitable as preparing for war.
Oh, I understand that.
So if you look at it from the people who really run the United States, there is way more money to be made in making and maintaining nuclear weapons than in risking the use of them. And in that sense, if you needed nothing else to reassure you, maybe hang on to that one, that in
dollars.
Well,
I just mean like, well, for example, I mean, I understand that, but say there's a naval confrontation in the Baltic Sea or in the Black Sea. And then people start making ultimatums to each other. And then there's another coup in Belarus this time, or whatever it is. I mean, shit can get out of hand.
No, but it happened constantly during the Cold War. The Russians, poke their army into countries all over the Middle East, or all over Eastern Europe. The United States had its own little forward front all through Central America. We were constantly bumping into each other with submarines and surface ships and airplanes in all the coastal areas. There were little flare-ups on the Korean border, inter-Korean border, whatever. It happened constantly during the Cold War, but it was in nobody's interest, financial or otherwise, for it to get too far out of hand. And you know, the militaries are good at following orders. And the idea was that in each and every case, somebody was told to back off and somebody backed off.
Yeah.
And that historical record is should not be dismissed lightly.
Yeah, I understand. And hey, who wants hydrogen fusion over their head? Nobody, not even nobody. Bush's or Clinton's.
Exactly.
But, okay, so here's my last best point about this then. Which is what Pat Buchanan says about how we used to draw the line at the Elbe River. And so when the Soviets cracked down in Hungary and in Czechoslovakia and in Poland during Eisenhower, LBJ, and Reagan, the Americans said, hey, not my problem. Sorry, right. Charlie. You know, our CIA might have encouraged you to do it, but we're not doing anything for you now, sucker. But don't you Soviets come into Western Germany. But that was ceding a hell of a lot to them, of course, as the right kicked and screamed ever since Yalta. Yeah. But point being that now we've drawn the line at Russia's western border and we have a military alliance with the Baltic states. And we keep working on overthrowing as many governments we have to in Ukraine until the situation is right for bringing them into NATO as well. And that this is the kind of thing where maybe the Russians would do something that we would severely disapprove of, but that Ike Eisenhower would have let slide, but that now we can't, because now you're turning your back on Article 5 of the NATO alliance and all of these things.
Yes, maybe. But I think, there's two conflicting arguments to answer that. But I think one of them will be the one that happens. And that is either that the Russians are smart enough to realize that the rules are a little different and understand that they have to participate within different rules, or that the U.S. side will recognize that the rules are made to be flexible. And, you know, this little sliver of Latvia that the Russians have always wanted their hands on or something is absolutely not worth nuclear war. I don't pretend to know enough about Ukraine to get into the nuts and bolts, but I can say that both sides have done an awful lot of weird, violent, nasty shit in Ukraine, and we've not gone to war over it.
Right. That's true. And going back to the Cold War, too, when the CIA supported the Nazi right back then, too.
Well, I mean, that's a long tradition for us. But I mean, my point is that the Russians let us do what we're all the nasty stuff we've been doing in the Ukraine. We've made a lot of noise about what the Russians have done in the Ukraine, but you know, the troops, you know, we haven't dropped the paratroopers in to push them back or anything. The point is that I think both sides recognize the value of flexibility. Saber rattling and fist shaking serves everybody's needs, but actual war serves nobody's needs. And I think in the end of the day, as during the Cold War, that will be what keeps the peace, possibly for all the wrong reasons or whatever. But I don't think we're going to war with Russia.
Well, there you go, everybody. Humanity's going to survive after all.
Yep.
The optimistic take from Peter Van Buren today. And I'm sorry, you know what? I think you did respond, but I was still talking over you about when I mentioned Ellsberg's book, The Doomsday Machine. Have you read that?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. I've read everything Daniel Ellsberg has written. He's a hero of mine and one of the highlights of my whistleblowing career was when Dan reached out and introduced himself, and I got a chance to sit down and have dinner with him.
Wow,
there
great.
You go.
Very cool.
I had dinner with Dan Ellsberg. How about that?
That is very cool. I've got to interview him a few times, and he blurred my book. So
he's quite a guy.
But that's not quite dinner, though. That's great. But yeah, so that book will give you the heebie-jeebies. And I guess for people who haven't read it, he comes into power as the deputy assistant, whatever, in the White House, overlooking nuclear stuff in the Jack Kennedy years. And he comes to find out that the plan is that if anybody shoots anybody in Berlin, we're going to nuke every city in Russia and China. And there is no other plan. And by the way, the war could start accidentally about 150 different ways. And it was his job to go, whoa, 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 and try to rewrite all of this stuff and try to get the military to even admit what their plans were and all this, and to try to make it a nuclear doomsday machine a little bit safer to operate. But then, he kind of ends it with, I haven't been there in a long time. I don't know how they do it now. And see, I'm a subscriber to what I think I'm going to start calling the George W. Bush theory of history, where all of our presidents are nothing but George W. Bush. Winston Churchill, nothing but George W. Bush. All of these guys are nothing but a bunch. I mean, look at you would think Ike Eisenhower would have been wise, but every bit of our mess in the Middle East is because of him.
Yep.
And his predecessors and successors. But you know what I mean with that 53 coup in Iran and the aftermath and all of these things. And so I could see him screwing up. I could see him getting us all killed accidentally, honestly,
The possibility of accidents happening remains. This has been my theory on the Koreas, by the way, just to throw this in so everybody can tell me I'm right as we watch The Last Sunset. it's never mind that we're going to have a nuclear war with North Korea. I'm deathly afraid of a Chernobyl-like level accident in North Korea that triggers the next thing.
That's a good point. That Yongbyon reactor, I'm sure you do know, was built by the Soviets and is run off of pretty highly enriched stuff, or certainly can be. It used to be run off of even weapons-grade uranium was fueling it back then.
And it's
I don't
hard
know
to
how
imagine,
it is now exactly.
Industrial
but.
Safety is a big thing in North Korea.
Yeah.
And so, no, my great fear there is an accident, a Chernobyl-level accident that causes the next thing, whether that next thing would be, for example, the Chinese to intercede, or a massive refugee flow into the South, or some kind of military coup. I mean, pick your favorite nightmare. But those kind of things are far more concerned to me because they lack logic. At the end of the day, whatever you want to say about Putin or whoever is the next Russian leader, these are still people that are trying to think these things through, albeit in a childish, ridiculously stupid way. But there's still a thinking process that means there's still a chance to intercede. But when you're talking about accidents that trigger spontaneous reactions, there is no logic there. It's just people running. And that's the most dangerous situation of all time.
Right. Yeah, there was that time the Air Force accidentally dropped a thermonuke on North Carolina, and 8 out of 9 safeties failed, I think they say, right?
Yeah. And
you got to wonder, if that H-bomb had gone off, would they have been able to admit that it was an accident, or they would have had to say it was an attack and respond as though it was an attack,
Yeah. Yeah. So the accidents, I think, are right now would worry me far more than any William Perry's thoughts that the Russians are going to launch a nuclear war or whatever.
Yeah. Well, man, I know it sounds like you got to go, but now we're talking about Korea. So I want to know, what's your take on the latest coming out of those negotiations there?
The latest, my take is the same take that I've been offering for 2 years now. There is room to negotiate always. And the United States may or may not have the skill, and we may or may not give our diplomats the time and space they need. North Korea is ultimately in an untenable position. They are going to have to engage with the world at some level, some point, in order to survive and to thrive. I think Kim Jong-un understands that. I think he wants to find a way to engage with the world. He will not do that without the umbrella of nuclear weapons. He has seen far too many examples across the Middle East of what the United States is capable of doing to a country it doesn't like that can't defend itself. And the United States will face the choice of engaging with a nuclear-armed North Korea as a starting point, or we will continue to just kind of noodle along as we have for the past 75-some years. I am in favor of engaging with a nuclear North Korea, of accepting that they will maintain a nuclear deterrent in the initial stages of their re-entry into the world. And I am adamant that their re-entry in the world will ultimately result in their backing off of that nuclear deterrent. But we're talking about decades of careful diplomacy here. An American media, which is insistent that everything Trump does is wrong, is not going to move the needle on this in any way. And my hope is that some resolution or some positive steps can continue to occur before an accident occurs. Kim Jong-un is a young man, but the lifespans in North Korea can be cut short fairly quickly. And I don't know that there'll be another opportunity following him. I don't know who would possibly succeed him. Could be a military coup, at which point there's no more negotiations. Kim, I think, can be diplomatically, I don't want to say manipulated, positioned into seeing himself as a historical figure, the Deng Xiaoping of his nation, the man who preserved North Korea's sovereignty and what they want to call their culture, while at the same time moving it into the modern world. If you had skillful diplomacy that gave him that opportunity to make himself that historical figure, I think there would be room to negotiate. I don't know that the United States has ever been capable of that subtlety. I think in the current circumstances between Trump's sort of need for short-term things and the American population and media's desire to see him fail at every step, I don't think this Trump is capable. A second-term Trump, I'm not sure about that either. Any of the Democrats currently that would win in 2020, not a chance at all. I think they would instantly backburner North Korea and we'd go back to just nothing. I think there is a window. I'm seeing it closing now, and it's a shame. I think a year ago, year and a half ago, history will say that we blew it. We missed a real chance to break down some of these barriers that could have led in the future to a non-nuclear North Korea. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, you know, the one little piece of good news from this week is that Stephen Biegun, however you say it, the State Department negotiator on this, who had previously said what you said, that, hey, we got to recognize that denuclearization would be nice, but it's not first on the list. We got to get, you know, it's okay to go ahead and make peace first and work out denuclearization later. Come on, it's the only realistic approach here. And then he was overridden on that or whatever. But anyway, my point was that he was offered, or at least they were talking about moving him to the Russia job, ambassador to Russia to replace Huntsman, and he declined it, even though apparently speaks Russian and is a great Russia expert. And he decided, no, I want to stay working on the North Korea case. Or maybe he had a conversation with Pompeo like that or something, and he's staying. So, you know, it's not unthinkable, even in the current State Department. You know, he said that at a speech and then was obviously overridden. But like you're saying, it's so obvious. It's the only thing. And you know, I don't know if Trump fails to do this, if only for political reasons, so he has something to claim as a victory, then he's worse than I thought, because he can do it himself. He doesn't need the Congress to ratify anything. He can just start lifting sanctions and normalizing relations in ways that, you know, can mean real progress toward normalization of relations. Sign a peace treaty to end the war from 1950 through 53 there.
Yeah, you know, it runs head on into a series of problems. Trump seems to want a big splash that he can use for to help him in 2020. The rest of America seems to be rooting for failure, so that in addition to the recession that they can't wait to happen, they can say something else went wrong. And the clock is running in North Korea. You know, we like to think of Kim and other dictators as these, you know, God kings that make decrees but Kim functions in, like every so-called dictator, Kim functions inside of a system. Now, he doesn't have Nancy Pelosi and AOC, but he has power centers in his country, economic power centers, military power centers, other political power centers that he has to juggle and he has to keep on board. And those internal windows open and close the same as they do in the United States. They're not as obvious to us and they're not as extreme, but Kim on his own can't just do this. And he can do certain things, but he can't do everything. And skillful diplomacy takes that all into account. I'm sorry to say that I just don't see Pompeo. I wish there was somebody there that was a little bit more of a diplomat. I think Pompeo sees himself as, you know, Trump's emissary to the State Department and more keeping it all under control than actually driving these issues. It would be nice in a second Trump term or maybe if Pompeo quits sooner than that, to have someone there who is willing to play a more active role and be a Secretary of State, and maybe take this issue on as their signature issue with Trump's backing. I mean, the president can only do so many things. He's only one person. And there's so much headwater on this issue that it'd be nice to get somebody who isn't named Trump kind of out in front of it, in hopes that the media and the Democrats would leave him alone long enough to try to get something done.
Yeah. It's too bad that he just, you know, he has a few good instincts. A lot of them are really bad, but some of them are not so bad. Like, let's get along with Russia and let's make peace with Korea and maybe pull our troops out of Syria a couple of things. But he appointed all hawks to serve him in all the most powerful positions. So he can't implement any of that stuff. All they do is argue with him all day long, and he gives in over and over again. Because he didn't have anyone to stand by his side and say, no, you guys, he's right. You know, Mr. President makes a great point here. It's you know, and his instincts, they're just that, right? They're hardly informed at all. So he can't win in an actual discussion or argument with anybody about stuff. You know, they tell him, boy, if we leave Syria, Iran will take over. And he goes, oh no, really? Boy, I better not do that then. And then that's it.
Yep. And we get these kind of goofy partial solutions where we pull most of the troops out of Syria, but we don't pull all of the troops out of Syria. And it's just like, okay, all right.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
anyway, but there's not going to be a nuclear war. So that's good.
Yep, we're safe on that. Pay your credit card bills, folks. Student loans, you're still going to be on the hook for that, kid. Yeah. Sorry.
But still, don't whitewash the Hiroshima bombing. That's the piece at the American Conservative magazine, theamericanconservative.com. Thanks.
Thank you.
Peter Van Buren. Oh, also check out We Meant Well is his great website. All right, y'all. Thanks. Find me at libertarianinstitute.org, at scotthorton.org, antiwar.com, and reddit.com/Scott Horton Show. Oh yeah, and read my book, Fool's Errand, Timed and the War in Afghanistan, at foolserrand.us.